Life is full of what-ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hi everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Wild Wild Podcast. I'm happy to introduce my co-host Rod Barnett. Welcome back, Rod.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Now let's be honest with each other here. Did you completely wipe out your savings over the Black Friday Blu-ray sales weekend? At the time of recording, it is Sunday. And it is Black Friday weekend.
I did, as usual, spend more than I probably should have. luckily, I've been able. I'm able to push off the expense of some of this stuff to, shall we say, first quarter of next year. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. But yeah, I did spend more than I probably should have. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, as always, Severin and Vinegar Syndrome put out some interesting stuff. I have to admit, I spent all my money with Vinegar Syndrome this time. Severin's gone very video nasty heavy this time round. I've never really been that bothered about video nasties. The only one that I would have liked to buy if it wasn't full price was the Blu-ray of Ruggero Deodato's House on the Edge of the Park. Because that's I've seen it. I've got a copy of it, and I don't know if I'd ever watch it again. So, but it's got a nice documentary about him, and he is a really cool guy. So I was sort of tempted by that, but I think I'll just wait for it to hopefully be reduced in a future sale.
Yeah. I bought it because it's part of. I bought it as a bundle because of that.
Oh, well done.
That signed book about Deodato's movies. I was just like, I can't pass that up. So
there was some interesting Italian things. I don't know if I really. What did I buy? I mostly just bought stuff I really didn't need, but quite wanted in the Vinegar Syndrome sale. So now I need to wait for my bank balance to recover, as usual with these things. Yeah, but it's all fun.
Well, I of course I'm a weird case in this respect, simply because Troy and I. We did an AshyCast commentary track for their Black Candles release. So,
well, yes, that's so, the bit. We should have mentioned that one first.
There's that.
That's the headline banner title release, Black Candles.
I don't know that I would put it that way. I think for Severin, I think I would say that. I guess House on the Edge of the Park and Bloody Pit of Horror might just be. I mean, I have to admit, I'm very curious, which is why I bought the bundle about the that new film from Deodato called Ballad and Blood. Yeah. And I'll admit, I don't have a whole lot of high hopes for it. I mean, you know, let's be honest. It's his first film in 23 years.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to maintain. I mean, when you're, I don't want to sound ageist, but I do want to sound like someone who knows what being out of the film industry for two decades can probably do to your ability to like string together a coherent film. And so I don't have a whole lot of high expectations for it, but I am curious to hear the score, which is also by Claudio Simonetti. So
that's true. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I forgot as well that the other interesting title there was Bloody Pit of Horror, which I will also pick up at some point. Perhaps in a future sale, because that'd be a fun one to cover, maybe even on this on the podcast at some point.
It's a fun film.
Yeah, so congratulations anyway on another commentary. You guys are much in demand, which is impressive.
That's the only real, that's the only track we've got coming up that hasn't already been announced. I mean, we've still got the track for Tombs of the Blind Dead whenever Synapse puts their Blu-ray of that out, which I'm guessing now will be sometime next year.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll all be in our tombs by the time that thing gets released.
I suspect it'll come out sometime next year, but I have no idea when, because I no way to know. So,
no. Yeah, no, that's very cool. Speaking of future releases, over the weekend, Vinegar Syndrome announced none other than Beast in Space.
They did?
Yeah.
Wow, I did not know that.
That's coming out next year in a 4K restoration.
Oh my god, that film does not deserve a 4K. No. Oh, wow.
I wonder if they'll take the opportunity to fix the aspect ratio problems.
Maybe
with the inserted horse footage, but it's all part of the charm, isn't it? So maybe not.
But yeah, Lord.
I was hoping, you know, if they're going to go down that route, maybe there's some hope that we'll get Escape from Galaxy 3 at some point, which I think would sit very nicely on the Vinegar Syndrome catalog.
Well, I think it would be a good idea if they were smart, if they could get their hands on both of those films, to package them together, as a kind of, you know, two disc or, you know, three discs, that however they had to spread things around. But it would be probably a smart idea.
Do a whole Beast in Space box set with all the other films from that quadrilogy, or was it?
Oh my god, that would be
that would be torture.
I can't say anything. I mean, I can't say anything. Some of the box sets that have been coming out in the past few years, I am both stunned and appalled that that there's an Al Adamson box set with 30 plus movies, and an Andy Milligan box set with all those things. It's like one of those things where you're just like, I had no idea we would live in such interesting times.
I just bought the Rene Cardona Jr. box set from Vinegar Syndrome as part of their sale. I ummed and ahed, but I couldn't resist it in the end. It hasn't even got Tintorera on it, which is a shame. Because that, you did a commentary for that, didn't you, from somebody else?
Oh yeah, that was a Kino. Kino put it out.
Kino,
it's Kino being it's Kino distributing. Oh darn it! I think it's Scorpion is the company that actually subleased the film. But yeah, it's an MGM film. And I did a commentary track with Troy Howarth on that film. Yeah,
that's really fun. Yeah, I need to. That's another one I need to add. So many films, so little time. But anyway, we could talk about Blu-rays and what we'd like to buy forever. But that's not the purpose of this podcast. We are back in the Trilogy of Life, Decameronticci genre, or basically rip-offs of the Decameron and films. This time we're looking at the Canterbury Tales. Ah, l'amore, l'amore, pizzica, tuzzica, friccica il cuore. Ah, l'amore, l'amore, fallo rifallo, ma non lo punta, fallo rifallo, ma non lo punta. And so Canterbury Tales, are you familiar with the original film of the Canterbury Tales?
I haven't seen it in a Pasolini. Very long time, but it's one of the it was one of the first Pasolini films I ever saw.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's not quite, it's not quite as explicit as the Decameron was. In the UK, Decameron is rated 18, whereas Canterbury Tales is only rated 15, although I was quite surprised by that, because those you still see rather a lot in there. But so he made this film in 1972, and it's really fascinating to watch for somebody who lives, you know, who is English, because he came over to the UK to film this thing, but he still shot it with primarily, I think, an Italian crew. And he's got some Italian actors and some British actors. There's some really well-known British actors that pop in there, pop up in there, like Tom Baker and Robin Asquith. And then you've got more sort of Italian people as well, like Ninetto Davoli. But just some of the imagery is really extraordinary in that film. But what I also liked was a lot of the locations. I recognise some of them, to the places I visited. And there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff filmed inside cathedrals around the country, and different places. And at least two of the locations I've seen when I've been on holiday. So that was quite fun. But yeah, the film is extraordinary, and it ends with this incredible sort of sequence of a monk going to hell to see what the devil does with other with friars. That's it. He's a friar, and he gets taken by an angel to see what the devil does with friars. And there's just this extraordinary sequence of the devil expelling friars out of his backside, just spraying these friars out. It's just really bizarre. So, but the most, I guess, the bit that was the most exploitative element of it all was the fact that most of the stories had some sex in them in some way or other.
Yeah,
and that was the bit that the Italian filmmakers picked up on. And I guess they knew, there must have been publicity, that they knew he was going to do the Canterbury Tales next after Decameron, that he had this trilogy already kind of mapped out, because it was very quickly that the Italians, after doing Decameron ripoffs, were very quick on the action to do some Canterbury Tales films. So there were a lot of them about. The one that we have chosen to focus on is... I've got a translation here. So the Italian title, I'll have a go. I racconti di Viterbi, le più allegri storie del quattordicesimo secolo, which translate the direct translation, as far as I can figure out, is Tales of Viterbi, the most cheerful stories of the 14th century. And so what they've done there, Viterbi is not a real place. Because at first, when I started watching this film, I didn't do any research first. I just watched it. And I thought, they haven't made much of an effort to make this look like Canterbury. Like, there's nothing English. This film doesn't look very English. And then I realised that Viterbi, they've called the Tales of Viterbi to make it sound like Canterbury. But it's actually another Decameron film. It's still set in Italy. And I think they must have called it Viterbi after the city of Viterbo, which is about 50 miles north of Rome. It's one of those medieval sort of 11th, 12th century walled cities. Mm-hmm. And I've been looking at pictures of it online, and it's really fantastic. So that's Viterbo. So I assume that Viterbi is from Viterbo. So they've sneakily called it Tales of Viterbi to make it sound a bit like Canterbury Tales.
Right.
But it's... So I was a little bit... sort of confused at first when I started watching it, that it wasn't, because I'd just watched Canterbury Tales first, and then there's no attempt to make it look English at all. But that explains it, because it's actually just another Decameron film disguised as a Canterbury film. But then the English title is The Sexbury Tales.
Yes.
Which is really original.
Well, I mean, it's better than the other title that I've seen it listed under, which is The Real Decameron.
Oh, yes. I did see that somewhere as well. I'm not sure who put it out as that, but yeah, The Real Decameron is another one. They seem to have many different titles, these films, as they get taken around. And I by another really happy coincidence, it turns out that this film was in my PhD. And I was completely not aware of that. I mean, that was 2 years ago now, 3 years ago now. So I've kind of put it at the back of my mind, but this film popped up in my PhD. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later. I'll bore you with some of my PhD stuff where this film fitted in. But yeah, so Sexbury Tales. Now, Rod, you were not a massive fan of Ubalda or Naked and Warm
right.
last time, despite the fact that Ubalda was played by Edwidge Fenech. So this time I asked you to watch the Sexbury Tales,
mm-hmm.
the Tales of Viterbury. What did you think about this movie compared to the last one?
I don't know if it's just that I'm getting used to this genre, or whether it's... I think it actually has to do with the structure. I really enjoyed this, and about halfway through, I realized I was really enjoying it, and realized that something had shifted within me. But I immediately figured out what it was, and you can probably guess. Ubalda was one long story. This mm-hmm. is an anthology film, and yeah. I gotta say, having each of these ribald little tales be only a few kind of random minutes long, you know, mm. There's no way to tell how this story is going to, how each story is going to wind up, what the punchline is going to be in, and exactly in which direction everything is going to go, really kind of engaged me. I have to admit, I enjoyed this, and I don't get me wrong. I know Ubalda, it's a very episodic film, but it's yeah. telling one long tale. And once I was tired enough of the characters in that film, it was just like, I need these people to go away. But I never mm-hmm. felt that way with the characters in this movie, because they don't stick around that long. I mean, we've got seven different stories here.
Yeah. And you're right. This, because they've done it, as a sort of portmanteau, that fits much more closely the idea of the Canterbury Tales and yeah. the Decameron, which is lots of short little stories. I mean, whereas in Pasolini's film, anyway, we don't really have a narrator as such. We cut back occasionally to Chaucer, which is played by Pasolini himself, writing stories down. But then we just see these stories play out, and they don't really, there's nothing to hang them together. Whereas this one is much more in the sort of Dr. Terror's House of Horrors mold, where you've got a group of people together, and then they're telling stories. Actually, that's not Dr. Terror, is it? Because that happens to them. There's maybe another one of those anyway. But that kind of anthology, maybe what's it? Torture Garden, perhaps. I don't know.
Well, I mean, in Dr. Terror's House of Horror, you have these guys on a train, and they're all...
Yeah, I suppose he's telling them the stories, isn't he?
Yeah.
In that one. So it kind of works. But yeah, but it's much more, you've got a framing device here where you've got a group of women who are doing their washing and they're having a hilarious old time doing the washing. And they're telling each other, it's like they're trying to outdo each other with each story.
Yeah.
So they just start telling each other, I think the word you used, ribald, is a good one. They start telling these ribald stories whilst doing the washing. And they're all having a really good laugh, and it kind of works. So what I thought I would do, I've got the very helpful review, because this did get a release in the UK, which is why it was in my thesis. So there's a review of it in the Monthly Film Bulletin. Although the film was made in 1973, it didn't make it over here until 1975. So I can tell you this review has a very helpful summary of each story.
Oh, cool.
So I thought, so we can go through each one and just talk about what we liked. Because, I mean, although I did really enjoy Ubalda, you're right that it went on a bit too long, because the story of Ubalda could have been one of these short stories. Like, they dragged it out.
Interminably, yeah.
Yeah, and I did enjoy how each of these stories had kind of quite a good punchline.
That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. Although, I mean, some of them were a little bit predictable, but still very funny. So, story number one. A wealthy innocent is tricked into marrying a widow's hideous daughter. Let's talk about that first. So, yeah. So there's a wealthy young man. He's just in town, I think, and he's looking for a bride.
Mm-hmm.
And he meets this woman, and she's like, oh, yes, well, you can marry my daughter. But there's a catch. He's not allowed to see what she looks like until after they've married, because, what was it she said? Because she'd prayed to the Virgin Mary, or she'd made a pledge to the Virgin Mary that,
mm-hmm.
that no man would see her daughter's face until she was married or something.
Now, as a film viewer, you're immediately suspicious. But
exactly.
But the thing is, I mean, the young man agrees to this mainly because he's looking at the mother and going, well, she's still an attractive middle aged lady, so this is not this is not a bad idea here. So.
Yeah, and just how attractive she is to him becomes part of the story very shortly. So they go to the bedroom after they've got married, and then she pulls back her veil. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you'd have thought it was a bit of a clue, because she kind of talks like this. She's got a bit of an E.T. sort of voice. So he's talking to her, and she's really short. I mean, it could have been E.T. She comes into the room, she's about 4 foot tall. They got this kind of voice. And but then he still agrees to marry her. It's really funny. So then she whips off the veil, and I was expecting it to be like a little old woman or something based on how she sounded. But it's a younger woman. She's not hideous, but she's not particularly attractive.
Well, she's got they've done their best to make up this obviously attractive young girl in such a way as to make her look terrible. I mean, with these bizarre, like, raised warts and things on, a couple of these odd, protuberances on her face. And, it gets the job done, but at the same time, it's one of those things where it's like, we spend a lot of time looking at her body, and it's like, I'm sure that there are enough enticements here for this young man.
He could have just got her to put the veil back on.
Perhaps we should go by what the nuns always say, darling, or whatever.
Yeah. Oh dear. Anyway, let's not.
I think we may have just come off as sexist assholes.
I know.
Right,
I'm a bit worried with this podcast how it's going to come across. But anyway, what's funny is that he doesn't know what to do once they get to the bedroom and they're there, and he doesn't know. Apparently she's desperate for it. He doesn't know how to do it. So she goes to complain to her mother that he doesn't know what to do in the bedroom. So the mother has a great plan. She will teach him what to do. And so she goes in and gets into bed with him and starts sort of explaining to him the facts of life.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of shows him what to do. And then she gets him to get on top of her, and then she's like, and then you know what to do, and he's like, I don't know what to do, and she says, do what the dogs do, or something, do what animals do.
Oh yeah.
So he just starts barking like a dog. So she thinks, okay, he's got it. The daughter comes back in, and then he's just barking like a dog on top of her again. So because the mother didn't teach him enough.
Yeah.
So the daughter comes out again, cries to her mother. The mother knows what to do. And then she gets back
into
bed.
She's not particularly unhappy about having to take this level of instruction on.
So. And so the story ends with the mother having a great time with the new husband while the daughter is crying and stamping her feet and being very cross in the room next door. And I don't know what the moral of that story is, but that's the end of that story.
Is there supposed to be a moral? Because I mean, I don't know how to extract a moral from this other than just being amused by the story and how it plays out. But
it's interesting that they ask him. They're surprised that he's never done it before. Like, there's an expectation as a man, like as a woman, that the daughter should be pure. She should be a virgin. That's all kind of accepted, but for a man to be a virgin, because he'd also made a promise to some saint or other that he was never going to touch a woman before being married, and they're like really surprised by that. Like, it was sort of expected that, I think she gave a whole list, you've never been in bed with a whore, and she lists like there's all these different words for types of women that he might have gone to bed with, and he's never done it. And I thought that was sort of, I don't know what that says about expectations of men versus expectations of women.
I will say this, that segment you just described, which is the mother-in-law talking to him and running through all the various derisive names that you can sling out for a woman. That's one of the first moments in the movie where I realized, okay, regardless of anything else that happens after this section is funny. Very funny.
Yeah.
Because the looks on the actress's face as she's slinging them out is like, well, maybe he just doesn't know these words. Let me keep going. It's very funny. I'm sorry.
It is. And it also kind of gives, it's quite a giveaway that we're in the 1970s here as well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that's just for story number one. We better try and fly through these, or this is going to be the longest episode ever. Oh, God, you're right, yeah. So the, all the women, they're laughing their heads off at that story, but then someone else has a better story. This story is about Tonya and Maniko,
right,
who are lovers kept apart by a family feud. And so Maniko keeps trying to get into the castle to get to Tonya, but the father doesn't want him anywhere near the castle and near his daughter, and he keeps threatening to kill this guy. And the story begins with Maniko disguised as a scarecrow so that he can try and kiss Tonya out in the field, but then the father comes along and is just constantly getting in the way. And eventually Maniko does manage to make it into the bedroom, I think.
Yeah.
But then isn't there, I forget, this story isn't quite as funny, but he does end up falling out of a window and landing in a load of manure. I can't remember now. But he eventually, he loses interest in Tonya after the constantly falling out of windows and getting beaten up and falling in manure. And then he walks off in a huff.
Well, yes, I mean, this is the story with at least initially the most kind of slapstick stuff, because this young man trying to sneak around to have sex with his beloved, we deal with a barrel filled with feces, you know, with manure.
Oh yeah,
he's trying to use to sneak in.
And oh, then, that was it. Yes, he's got these guys.
It was supposed to be a wine barrel, and then the guy's like, yes, "Well, I'll just fill it with manure."
And that then, was it, because he suspects that the guy is in there, doesn't he?
Right. Well, I don't know at the beginning, but then by the time he's chasing the guy away from his house with a scythe, I think we're pretty much on to things.
Oh,
and
yes.
I thought it was amusing that he essentially turns his daughter Tonya's room into a jail cell.
Yeah. Oh yeah, there's bars on the window. Mm-hmm. And she puts a rope down, she ties the sheets together, and he tries to climb up and falls down, and then she ties them to the bars on the window, and the bars fall out and land on top of him. Yeah, there's a lot of Laurel and Hardy type slapstick going on. Yeah, in
the it's probably my least favorite of the segments, yeah, but once again, it has the positive aspect of being brief. So
this is the one I'd forgotten the most about. But yeah, you're right. He tries to smuggle himself in a barrel that's going to get filled with wine in the cellar. So he's waiting for the barrel to get taken down to the cellar so that he can get out. But instead it gets filled with manure. Yeah, very good. Okay, the next story. This is perhaps one of the highlights, I think, of the film. Story number three.
Yeah.
Having married the elderly Theodore for his money, Mona arranges for her lover, Michelle, to disrupt their wedding night by masquerading as a ghost.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mona, this is, of course, none other than Rosalba Neri.
Yes, indeed.
And so this is quite a fun story where there's just a lot of running around a castle with a guy with a sheet on his head pretending to be a ghost.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it, yeah. There's a little bit more to it, but... I will say there's a little bit more to it. Very, very much so, especially once the wizard / exorcist shows up. So.
Yeah. Well, because she's hoping to scare the husband away so then she can have it away with her short, skinny, mustachioed Italian lover. Mm-hmm. Under the sheet. This is a sort of typical 1970s Italian sex comedy where the man is a tiny little man and the woman is a sort of statuesque goddess.
Yes.
In comparison. But then Theodore runs off to get a priest or an exorcist or like a wizard. So she's trying to get it away with the ghost, but then the priest comes back. And the ghost, there's a lot of running around where he's trying to scare away the priest. He's trying to scare away the husband.
Uh-huh.
In the meantime, there's a turkey that keeps popping up. And he's constantly getting... And they seem to think the turkey is... I don't know. In the end, it seems like the turkey is the one who ends up in the bed with her and not the men. There's a lot. It's very farcical, this one. It's a, like, typical sort of British bedroom farce with people running around losing their trousers and in and out of cupboards.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of the what I would refer to as kind of the standard 76 comedy humor in this, with you know, the new wife who's clearly married this guy for his money, actually extracting money from him in bed before they get started. I mean, like, actually demanding cash.
Oh yeah.
the story has a lot of accidentally self-inflicted violence, you know, and then once the ghost shows up, and before it's revealed that it's fake, it's kind of amusing, because at first I honestly thought, oh well, wait a minute, is this someone attempting to find a way to, like, extract money from this guy? No, yeah. No, it's all about sex. I forgot.
Yes.
I was amused by the exorcist in his pronouncements, like, women are all devils, and his of course, as you might expect for a story of this type, his methodology for exorcising the ghost does involve him attempting to have sex with the wife, and
I think he trained at the same monastery as the monk in our last film who. In order to teach women what sin looked like, he would just have sex with them.
Well, just as an aside, real quick, are you? You know who Miss Neary was, and I'm sure you've seen her in a number of films. And I'm always saying she's still alive and kicking, but she retired just a couple of years after this movie. After she made this movie, yeah. I mean she made like nearly 100 movies. And she retired and went into private life doing something completely different. And yet she made so many movies. I've seen her in so many films. She just seems eternally, I don't know. She just seems an eternal part of my viewing joy. I mean, she was Lady Frankenstein, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's just.
And she did a lot of giallos and stuff that we'll have seen.
Yeah, she did some Jess Franco films.
Yeah, the Fu Manchu that she did, the Jess Franco Fu Manchu.
Yeah, the worst of the Fu Manchus. But she was also in 99 Women for him, which is not terrible. And
there's one film that I'd really like to see that I haven't yet is Top Sensation.
Yeah,
with Edwidge Fenech.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've heard lots of things about and never seen. But yeah, she was very committed to Italian cinema for a number of years. And then she's even in that Pam Grier film, The Arena.
Yep.
Which I, another one that I need to add to my list. But yeah, and I noticed she's done quite a few giallo, some of which are in those box sets from Vinegar Syndrome. So yeah. But
it's very easy to run across her. I highly recommend Amok. From 1972, as a pretty good starting place, and also she is the thing that snaps the film The Devil's Wedding Night into sharp focus.
Uh-huh.
She's kind of amazing in that. So yeah.
She did another Decameron film as well before this one. So this is like old ground for her.
She did, in
this movie.
Which Decameron? Which other Decameron film did she do? Oh my goodness!
She did one called Decamerone Quattordicesimo Secolo, which also known as the New Decameron, I think.
Hmm. Okay.
In 1972. So, very busy. But yeah, it's interesting that she just sort of disappeared.
They say she essentially just retired, and that's kind of amazing. I mean, her and she started. Appearing in films in 1958, and then by the late 70s, she was just, I've had enough and I'm out of here. So
yeah, I mean, you know, once you, if you've been in Lady Frankenstein, it doesn't get much better than that.
Not in my opinion.
So great. In fact, we did, I'll have to tweet this out, we did a episode of your podcast a couple of years ago on Lady Frankenstein.
Yes, so wonderful movie.
That film at length. The next story, this is also quite a good one.
Yeah.
And this one, again, I don't want to sound overly sexist, but
there's no way around some of the discussions of this film, honestly, that aren't going to lead us down the garden path of sounding like sexist scumbags. I mean, yeah.
The young actress in this story, now I've totally lost the names of who is who, so I'm not entirely sure. I think this one is about a girl called Fiora, played by Christa Linder, who was German, if I've got that
right.
Oh,
I think so, yes.
And so she plays... I guess we can tell that she's not Italian because she's pretty much the only blonde woman in the film. Her name is Fiora. She's bathing nude in the river, mm-hmm. and then she suddenly starts clutching at herself and claiming that a shrimp... has swum up inside her while she was bathing. Oh, and the reason this story is being told is because the women washing the clothes, one of the women is just sort of squatting down in the water having a pee. She's having a pee in the water that they're washing their clothes in, which I thought was interesting. And then they tell her, oh, you want to be careful because you don't forget what happened to Flora. And then so we see the story. So yeah, so she gets this prawn, swims up inside her. So she's groaning in agony, and her mother calls the doctor. The doctor comes to do an inspection, and
he has a prescription. Yes.
Yeah, he basically like pokes a stick up inside her to try and see if he can get it out. But he says it's too far up there; it won't come out. But he's got this. Formula or something, and so he has an idea that the way to get this thing out is to get a man to come and have sex with her, but to paint this stuff on himself first, which will attract
This is how we're going to administer this medicine.
Yeah, and this will attract the prawn to bite onto this, whatever this is, and
onto the poor lad. Yes,
and then it will come out. Which sounds completely reasonable.
Ridiculous.
I think that sounds fine. That's very believable. And so that's what happens. So the servant boy, he is told to come and basically do this, but he's not told why.
Mm-mm.
So he's not... he's like, well, yeah, okay.
And really? So, you're telling me I have to do this? Oh my God!
I think the reason that the mother agrees to this particular treatment is because she has been assured by the doctor that the daughter is no longer a virgin because
the hymen has been severed because of the treatment. Evil shrimp, yes.
And so that's fine then. That means that she hasn't got to worry about her virginity anymore, but it won't affect her marriage chances. I think that's basically the logic of it all. Like, so
big quotes around the word logic there, yes.
Yeah. So the servant boy comes and has a great time, mm-hmm. until he suddenly screams and jumps out of bed and runs away screaming. And and then the mother comes running in and the doctor comes in and they're like, yay, she's cured. But then...
She has a bit of information to impart. Oh my goodness!
But then there's a further twist, which is that so she tells her mother that she thinks the prawn has laid eggs, and now there's millions up there. So
Piero, get them all out, yeah.
Piero is out recruiting local men and telling them, "There's this woman, and she'll just have sex with you, and it's great. She's really good." But the strange thing is that she wants you to run out screaming at the end. So it's all a ruse. But I wasn't entirely sure at which point it becomes a ruse. Like, did she make up the whole thing from the beginning just so that she had an excuse to have sex with loads of people? Or, possibly more likely, was the first one real?
I think she was an incredibly smart woman who knew a way around the rules. I think that she, yeah. I think she dreamed this up from the jump. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how she, but yeah, but would she have known that the cure the doctor would come up with would be that particular cure? But maybe she just, yeah, maybe she saw her opportunity here to have sex with the whole town for medical reasons.
Yes, exactly. This is the only way I can live is to have sex with every man in the town who's willing to have sex with me.
As long as they're willing to run out screaming to pretend they've got a prawn. So, yeah, there you go. That's quite an unusual tale, but also quite funny.
Yes,
and true. I mean, I think there's no denying that Christa Linder is an attractive actress.
Very true. I was looking through the films that she did. She didn't do all that many, sad to say. She didn't do as well. I should say she didn't do as many as Miss Neary. But
no.
I have seen several of her movies, including more than one movie that she made in Mexico. A couple of the Mexican wrestling movies. She was in a couple of those, which I thought amusing. She was also in Night of a Thousand Cats. She had a small role in the Burt Reynolds film Hooper in 78, which I thought had to be the strangest bit of information there.
Yeah. I saw her in Day of Anger, which is a great movie.
Great speculation. Yeah. She's also in a couple of the Commissar X films, those German spy movies.
And she's also in that other Decameron film that Rosalba Nera was in. So
They're all
hanging around. But yeah, she also turns up in Young Dracula, Lucio Fulci's kind of sexy comedy.
Dracula in the Provinces. Yeah, same. Yeah.
And then she's in a British film. Is it a British film? Oh, no, it's a Mac Ahlberg's. It's a Swedish film. It's a film called For Men Only. There is a British film called For Men Only, which I was getting it mixed up with, but this is a Swedish one. So anyway, yeah, quite interesting various things that she popped up in. But yeah, she's very amusing in this sequence and also extremely attractive. Anyway, story number 5. This one is about a farmer with his young wife. And his young wife is terrified of sex because she has been raised to believe that men have a monster in their trousers.
Mm-hmm.
And she's having nightmares about this monster coming to get her.
A purple monster.
Yeah, and she makes the farmer sleep in a different room because she's so afraid of what he's got down there.
I think it's hilarious that the husband is not only being denied sex with his wife, but he's being forced to sleep with the chickens. So he's in the hen house, which has so many different little layers of joke.
Very
there.
Good. I hadn't even thought of that. You're right. Yeah, he is in the hen house. And so he comes up with a plan, which is he tells her that he's got two, actually. Mm-hmm. He's got the regular monster, but then he's also got a smaller monster that's fine. And
that she should not be afraid of the smaller one.
Yeah. So she agrees. She gives in. She's a little bit scared at first, but very quickly comes to enjoy it to the point where she becomes insatiable.
Yes.
And it doesn't take long before he is exhausted because she is just dragging him anywhere, behind a tree, in the barn, all day, all night. And he's like he's trying to hide from her. It's really funny. He's hiding from his wife because it's too much for him. But then she tells him that she's no longer afraid and she'd like to try the big monster.
Yes, and that's when the look on his face goes even more sour because now he's like, oh, great, what do I do now?
He got himself into trouble. So that story's quite short, but pretty funny. Mm. I mean, you could so many of these stories, and obviously they're all being written and directed by men. There's a lot of male fantasy fulfillment in.
Of course.
It's sort of funny, but also it's very much again of its time, I suppose.
I mean, this film, as are most of these, as are pretty much any Italian sex comedy. I'm sure there are a few that don't quite fit this bill for whatever reason, but I mean, these are voyeuristic pieces from the viewpoint of the male gaze. There's no way around that, and therefore, to a large extent, are inherently sexist. And if you know that going in, you should be just fine.
Yeah. So the next story is about a prisoner who has robbed a bishop of his clothes. So he's an escaped prisoner.
Yes.
And the bishop is hiding under a bush because his clothes have been stolen. Meanwhile, so this prisoner, he ends up being asked to come to help a woman who is dying, she claims.
Mm-hmm.
But basically she's not really dying. She's just frustrated because her husband lost he's now a eunuch because he lost his tackle in the war,
yep.
in the Crusades or something. And so the wife needs the last rites reading to her because she's dying. So the bishop is asked to come and read the last rites to her.
I'm sorry, but that long pause you had there, I thought you were about to leap ahead in the story.
Oh, no. Well, you go ahead. So,
oh, well, no. It's essentially, I enjoy this because we have the criminal, the escaped criminal that the soldiers are hunting for, who's stolen the bishop's vestments, and he comes to this house where this lady is pining for a confession because her husband cannot service her, shall we say.
Yeah.
And he takes a whiz, which turns out to be outside her bedroom window, and she sees his naked member and realizes, oh, wait a minute. Maybe something can happen here. So she entices the fake bishop into her bedroom. He comes up with a reason the husband can't be there, and bingo bango, exactly what you would expect would happen.
The bed collapses at one point.
Mm-hmm. I love that the fact that the servants are watching.
Yeah, oh, that's true. They're just watching through the keyhole.
Mm-hmm.
This unorthodox priest.
And then the husband, of course, realizes what's happening and charges in. There's a rather amusing fight between the two men. And the thing is, the fake bishop, he's a burly man, and he's you know, I'm thinking to myself, this is a brave dude to rush in there to take this guy on. And he ends up diving out the window. And I have to say that this is a really satisfying little vignette here. He dives out the window and is captured by the soldiers because he dives directly into the
he dives into a net, doesn't he?
Well, yeah, a fishing net that's been strung there for, you know, for repair. And so he's captured, and the soldiers ride up, and boom, end of story. Which is pretty satisfying little tale.
That's not how I remember that ending. I thought he was caught in a net by Baccio himself, by the guy and his wife, because the whole thing was a ruse. Because in the next shot, he is trapped in a mill. He's tied to a mill.
Oh, that's right. The soldiers with don't a load. Get him.
No, it's actually, like, it's all been a ruse to make him work in the mill, because there's about three other priests. Because
they chained him to the mill.
Yeah. There's like three other priests down there all pushing this mill around who've been there for years, because this seems to be something that it's like the most elaborate way of kidnapping people that they've ever come up with.
But still very amusing.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. Now, the last story is... this one feels very much like it could have been in the actual Canterbury Tales movie. So we've got this man whose name is Checho, mm-hmm. And he is famous for his sexual prowess. All the women want to be with him. And there's a man nearby in the village who hears of this man, and he recognizes the description straight away that this must be the man who got his sister pregnant. And so he runs to go and catch this man and sort of threatens to kill him, basically, unless he agrees to marry his sister. Now, in this one, I wanted to mention a random bit of information, that the actor that plays the stud in this story, he's Roberto Dell'Acqua. We've come up against the Dell'Acquas before. They're the Italian stunt family, whose names you see pop up in credits all the time. In fact, Roberto Dell'Acqua himself was one of the zombies in Zombie Flesh Eaters, or Zombie 2, which is the sort of the name that the film that perhaps the Dell'Acquas are most associated with. But they did a whole bunch of films, that family. That was interesting, and this is one of them.
Yeah, he's not credited because he's just a member of the stunt team in a lot of these movies. And, you know, but he, you know, he was, good Lord. I mean, he was in Nightmare City and the Beyond, mm-hmm. as, you know, an uncredited member of the, you know, the bunch of zombies that are made up to be part of that movie. But he was in so many stinking films. He was in Star Odyssey, for those following along at home. He played a character named Norman, but strangely enough, he was also the chimney sweep in, Robert Altman's Popeye film.
Oh, I was, because that was, wasn't that shot at Chinachita?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it was.
Or, so it was shot. Yeah, part of it was. Part of it was shot there. But he was, you know, he had like credited roles in some pretty amazing stuff, like The Big Racket and several Westerns. But if you look at his credited stuff, it's pretty impressive. But his uncredited stuff, where he's there as part of a, you know, he's like a bit player or as someone who's there to do stunts or play, you know, kind of a, as a utility player for, you know, in different positions as the film is made. He had an impressive career. And yeah, you're right. Mm. As part of that family, that's not a real shock.
No. So it's nice to see him getting a bit of a starring role in this sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And he seems to be genuinely remorseful, and he agrees to marry this guy's sister and to go with him to marry his sister. But I've forgotten exactly how this... there's a fight. That's right, because I think the military are also after this guy.
Yeah, it's a fight that kind of turns into what I would refer to as a barn orgy.
Yeah. And they end up just chucking all these guys out the window, which is quite fun. Because I think the big guy, Agnolo, who's the one whose sister is pregnant, he agrees to fight for Chicho and to help him.
Chicho.
Let's not go there.
You've gone insane, sir.
So he agrees to help him fight all these soldiers if he'll marry his sister. So then they disguise themselves, or Chicho puts on the costume of one of the military. Or is he already in the military? No, I think he puts on the captain's uniform or something. So he's going with Agnolo, and then they see the another group of the military coming towards them. So Chicho goes, okay, quick, I'll pretend, you know, go along with me. And he pretends to that he's the captain to this group of soldiers so that they're not suspicious. But then he tells the soldiers that he's arrested a prisoner, an escaped prisoner or something, and they need to take this guy away and send him to prison. And he's like, no, I'll get you. And so our young stud is free again to ride the countryside and get more
I was about to say I would put it that the young stud is once again free to spread his seed far and wide.
Yeah, and then so that's the final story, and we come back to the women who are still washing their clothes, having a good laugh, and then one of them talks about her own husband, who is a captain in the army, and how he's too busy being an army person to give her what she needs, and they're all having a good laugh about that. And then we see him come along. He comes past. And she wants to talk to him, and he's like, no, I'm busy, I'm in the army. But then basically the whole sort of battalion, whatever they are, end up being dragged in by these women, and they're all just a big writhing mass on the floor. And that's the end. Is that about right? I think that's about right.
It's fairly accurate, yeah.
So this monthly film bulletin review says the usual ragbag of Decameronian bawdy, if anything, rather shoddier and more witless than its dreary predecessors. It's a bit harsh.
Yeah.
Even potentially piquant stories like the one about the shrimp and the sex pot are reduced to ashes.
Oh my God.
So they didn't like it very much. I think it's quite witless, but I'm glad that you thought it was funny.
I actually, like I say, the secret is in keeping these silly little stories short, and therefore I was engaged throughout and kind of surprised at how much I was enjoying myself.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, it was a fun one. We didn't mention, of course, that this is directed by Mario Caiano.
Yes,
who is perhaps best known to
People of our stripe.
People like us, as being the director of Nightmare Castle, which is a classic, of course.
I'm a big fan of a number of his films, including from that same year, 1965, Eric the Viking. I'm a fan of the Italian Viking movies because there's just something bizarre about them. I think it's because I saw some of them at a younger age, and therefore somehow an Italian Viking movie strikes me as more authentic than any other Viking movie. It shouldn't, but it somehow does, yes.
Yeah, he's a very experienced director, and I think that comes across, that this is a pretty well-made little film.
Yeah. This is a guy who seemed to be able to play across pretty much any genre. I mean, the guy made, you know, spaghetti westerns like Shanghai Joe and Violent Milan. So you're talking about the Polichetski stuff as well. I mean, he also made Nazi Love Camp 27. So there's very few areas of the the exploitation world that he did not dip a toe. So
yeah. But that's just, that was what it was like when you were, if you were a working director and you were not a Pasolini or a Fellini, you were just directing whatever jobs were available.
Well, I would think that he would have a little bit more authorship over these, because he's also listed as a credited writer on the credited writer on this film and on like about 30 movies, mostly the ones that he had that he directed. But I mean, he's credited for having the idea for the film, In the Folds of the Flesh, and he wrote the screenplay for Eye in the Labyrinth. So, you know, who the heck knows? Apparently did the Italian dialogue for The Son of Captain Blood in 1962. So he seems to have cracked open the door to making films by being a writer first, and then worked his way into being a director.
Yeah, that's interesting. So around this time, so there were a lot of, and we talked a bit about this last time, there were a lot of, this was the sort of the beginnings of the birth of the sexy Italian comedy films, which dominated Italian cinema throughout the 70s. The films that tended not to travel that much overseas. And there are just loads of them. And I've been trying to find anything, the sort of academic analysis of those films, anything written about them. I mean, I haven't found anything yet about these particular, the Dick Cameron films. But what I have been reading about Italian sex comedies, almost every reading I've looked at talks about the fact that incest plays a big part.
Oh my goodness,
so many of the Italian sex comedies feature incest in some way, and that's a recurring theme in the Italian sex films of the 70s, which is interesting. And I suppose the closest we get with this one, I was thinking about it, is the first story with the son, the mother and son-in-law.
Yeah,
I suppose.
But that's not even real. I mean, I would not. Yeah, I wouldn't term that necessarily incest, but yeah, that is as close as this film
is. As close as we get. But I thought that was interesting. That seems to be a recurring theme. Maybe we'll discover a bit more of that as we go on to further Italian comedies in the future. But I wanted to mention then, so this film was distributed in the UK in 1975. So when I looked it up, I discovered to my delight that it was distributed by Border Films. And Border Films had played a big part. I've got most of a chapter of my thesis was about Border Films. So I could bore you to death for hours about Border Films. But I'll give you...
Try to do it in 5 minutes. Go.
Yeah, I'll give you the very quick version. So there was a distributor called EJ Fancy, and he had something of like a family... It was a big family business, basically. And he had several companies, and his children worked for him, and everybody worked for him. And so Border Films were connected. They were one of the companies that were connected to EJ Fancy. But where it gets a little bit weird is that EJ Fancy, so he had a wife and two children, and his two children worked for him. They ran the companies. One of the companies they ran was called New Realm. But sometime in the 1940s or maybe 50s, he also took upon him a second wife, like a common law wife, whose name was Olive Negus. And she started calling herself Olive Negus Fancy. And he had two more children with Olive, and they also worked for him. And this is all at the same time, because these two other children are around the same age as the children he has with his actual wife.
Oh my God.
I know. And so EJ Fancy's got a few different offices in Soho. The main one is not too far away from where Border were based. They were in a separate office just a bit further down the road on Wardour Street. So he's got his wife and his children working for him in one office. And then he's got his other wife and his other two children working for him at Border Films just down the road.
This is a sex comedy in reality.
So, yeah, that's all a bit bizarre. And it seemed to be fine, although, because I interviewed people that worked for the Fancies. Because I tried to talk to some of the surviving family, but nobody would talk to me. The closest I got was one phone call conversation with his son that he had with Olive Negus, who worked for Border. But in the end, he wouldn't do an interview with me. So I ended up interviewing other people that worked for the Fancy family. And it's a fascinating and strange story. But anyway, so Border specialized in, as did EJ in a lot of his other companies, but Border particularly specialized in importing European sex films, basically, for the UK market. So in 1975, I looked this up because I've got it all on a spreadsheet. In 1975, they distributed this film. They also distributed the more sexy Canterbury Tales. So they had two Canterbury Tales films in the same year. More Sexy Canterbury Tales was actually potentially directed by Joe D'Amato, but I looked it up, and there are two different directors depending on which website you look at. But that film, the Italian title translates as Flirtatious Stories of Pleasure-Seeking Wives and Penitent Husbands, which is good. So okay. That was so they distributed that one. They also did a film called My Darling Slave. They did a film called Sexually Yours, Sex Crazy, and Knickers Ahoy, and Naughty Girls. I know, and Naughty Girls. So that was just in 1975. So that's the kind of stuff that Border were doing. And then, so also in this year, what I did on my thesis, I did a search for every film distributed in the UK, and I kind of did all these different keywords. So I had words such as, what did I include? Sex, sexy, erotic. I was trying to work out like how many sex films were distributed basically in each year. Love, virgin, naked. I did searches on all these different words and came up with to give me a sort of rough idea. And in 1975, I got 44 films in that year that were all had the words sex or sexy or erotic or something like that in the title.
Yeah, it's certainly a profitable business to be in at that period of time.
There was a lot of this going on. So you had independent distributors like Border just making all their money by getting these kinds of films, which would have probably been pretty cheap at the time, and then putting them into sex cinemas. I mean, we didn't have, unlike America, we didn't have hardcore here at the time. There were some private cinemas that were screening hardcore, but it was basically illegal. It certainly wasn't like the kind of stories you hear of the grindhouses in America. So these films were about as sexy as it got and as explicit as it got in British cinemas at that time. So these were films that were receiving certificates from the BBFC. So this film did get an X certificate from the BBFC. So there you go. So I thought that was quite a nice coincidence that this is one, because a few of the films that we've looked at in this podcast so far never got released over here, but finally we get to one that did. It also had a VHS release in the UK in the 80s, so it's got it's obviously a bit of interest in the movie at various points, but that was the last time that anybody over here would have seen it on its 80s VHS.
Well, does that mean that there was an English dub for the film? Because I saw it subtitled. So
yes, there was. Yeah, the only version that I can find now is the subtitled version. Hmm. But they distributed it in a dubbed version.
Interesting.
Border may have paid for that dub themselves. There were various dubbing houses around Soho that just spent all day every day dubbing films like this. It's possible that they might have done a dub in Italy, because they also, as we know from other films we've talked about, they had people who lived in Italy who just spent all their time dubbing English.
Yeah.
I mean, you've talked about people like that before in your podcast, of some of these American actors who went to Italy and then ended up just working in dubbing for years. So it could have happened at either end. I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, there was a dub at some point.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there you go. So finally, my PhD was worth something. I have.
Well, I'm always curious to see the reason it's a shock that this one was. I mean, it shouldn't surprise me. And there was an American release as well. But
I couldn't find that. That's interesting.
Well, I mean, that's just it. There's an American title,
And this is not the kind of film that anybody was going to release over here theatrically anyway with subtitles. This is not, you know, you're not looking for that kind of audience with this kind of film. And so that's interesting that there's, I would love to know how some of the jokes may have been altered from the Italian to the English dub. You know, there can be shifts in, you know, the emphasis of the humor or exactly what the joke might be. And I'd be curious to kind of figure that out.
Yeah. So, yeah, so I mean, basically the reason I chose this particular film was just because some of the other Canterbury Tales films I wanted to do didn't have any English tracks or subtitles available. And so there were some, from what I've looked, there were some Canterbury Tales films that did try and pretend to be British and look a bit more kind of British medieval.
Mm.
Whereas this one is still just very Italian,
yeah,
basically. Yeah. And just linking to Canterbury through its title. But there were many other ones that we could have talked about. But yeah, I think it's just a really interesting example of this kind of the way that the Italians worked. And, you know, if something is popular, let's just flog it to death until and then move on to the next one.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, just keep going like that. Now, what's exciting about our next episode is we'll be looking at the Arabian Nights films for that one, which I'm really looking forward to. The film that we're going to do is an Antonio Margheriti film, and it's worth mentioning that he also did do a Canterbury Tales film, Antonio Margheriti,
called
Novella Galette d'Amore. Which I think is now lost. I did some research before trying to find it, and it's one of his missing films, as far as I can tell. It may be in Italy somewhere, but it's gone.
That's incredible, really.
Yeah, can't find it anywhere. But at least his Arabian Nights film is available, so that's the one we're going to do next time.
All right.
Yeah, so we'll talk more about that next time. But yeah, so there you go. So that's been Canterbury Tales. And definitely, this one's definitely worth a watch. It's quite easy to find a copy online if you know where to look. I don't think it's commercially available, but we did find a copy with English subtitles. If any of you are curious, then just look in the usual places and you should find a copy. Yeah, thank you again, Rod, for doing this.
Glad to be here.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. You can get in touch with us in all the usual ways. Please do talk to us on Twitter. That's mostly where we get our all our contacts. The links are in the show notes. And, yeah, we will talk to you again. Maybe we'll see how it goes. Maybe before Christmas or maybe in the new year. but we'll try and see if we can fit one of these in December so that we can start the new year with a new season. But we'll see. I'm not making any promises. Right. Thanks, everybody, for listening, and goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Donna Teresa, ti vuoi rassegnare, tanto le corna devi portare. Donna comare che fili la lana, metti a riposo la tua sottana. Otto rotondo che ridi giulivo, fregate quanto l'annacque questo vino, vecchio crociato che hai perso lontano, tutti i denari è una cosa che fa. L'amore, l'amore, pizzica tutti i capricci che il cuore. All'amore, l'amore, fallo rifallo ma non lo punta, fallo rifallo ma non lo punta. Frate che frasi raccolto in preghiera, cento peccati prima di sera, dentro una casa si sente il lamento, letto che cigolo porta nel vento. Viva la faccia del padre priore, dentro al convento struisce le sore, corono strillano, sembra un pollaio, quando la notte le fa confessare. L'amore, l'amore, pizzica, stuzzica, friccica il cuore. Ah, l'amore, l'amore, fallo
fallo rifallo ma non lo conta, fallo rifallo ma non lo conta.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.